This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shoba Genzo, case 101. Nanways, it's not like something in the main case. Zen Master Nanwei went to study with the sixth ancestor, Huainong. The sixth ancestor said, "Where are you from?" And Nanwei said, "I came from the national teacher, Huiwan of Songshan." The sixth ancestor said, "What is it that has come like this?" Nanwei couldn't answer. He attended the master for 8 years and worked on the question. One day he came to Huainong and said, "Now I understand it. When I first came to study with you, you asked me, what is it that has come like this?" The sixth ancestor said, "How do you understand it?" Nanwei said, "To say it's like something misses it." The sixth ancestor said, "Does it depend upon practice and enlightenment?" And Nanwei said, "It's not that there is no practice in enlightenment. It's just that they cannot be divided." The sixth ancestor said, "Just this, undivided, is what Buddhas have maintained and transmitted. You are like this, I am like this, all the ancestors in India were like this." The commentary. To set up monasteries and establish the teachings is like adding flowers to brocade. The wisdom that has no teacher pervades the whole universe, reaching everywhere. When it's truly seen, you go deaf, dumb, and blind. What is there to compare this to? How can it be expressed? Indeed, how can it be understood? Take off the blinders and set down the backpack. This is the peaceful dwelling. This is why it is said the 10,000 sages have not transmitted a single particle of the truth. And yet students throughout the world labor over appearances and grasp at reflections. Tell me, since it's not transmitted, then why are there so many complicated koans and teachings? The capping verse. Blue sky, bright sun, there's no distinguishing east from west. Yet acting in accord with the imperative still requires dispensing medicine when the sickness appears. So, as you no doubt recognize, this is the a koan that Dogen used both in the fascicle that we're studying, Body Mind Study of the Way, and then also in this koan itself, in the collection that he assembled. And so the fascicle begins, "The Buddha way cannot be attained unless you practice, and without study it remains remote." And then he recounts this dialogue between Nanwei and the sixth ancestor. In the translation that Kazen Daidaroshi did for the koan collection, Nanwei is said, "It's not that there is no practice in enlightenment, it's just that we should not be defiled by them." And in the Shoba Genzo, he translated, "It's just that they cannot be divided, practice and enlightenment." So Nanwei comes to Huainong, so this is early in the Zen tradition, and he says, "Where have you come from?" He said, "I came from the national teacher." And then Huainong says, "What is it that has come like this?" Buddhism teaches that after all, we just want to be happy and peaceful. We want to be without suffering. But what does that mean, to be happy? The Four Immeasurables gives voice to, I wish that all beings would be happy and know the source of their happiness. I wish that all beings would be free of suffering and know the cause of their suffering. Lest we be wishing for just a superficial passing happiness or alleviation. What is the source and the cause? So Huainong says, "What is it that has come like this?" This is the great question. This is the question that is the heart of how do we live a life that is at peace and unhindered and that is generous and a benefit to others. In coming, in arriving, in appearing, what is it that has come, that appears, that arrives? In birth, what is it that is born? What is mu? What is your original face? All of the koans, all of the teachings are pointing to this. And so how do we ask this great question? How do we ask a question? How do we inquire? Being as we are in a path of inquiry, how do we inquire? How do we inquire in such a way that we understand what we're asking? What is the question? But we don't get tangled up in the meaning of that question. Right? What does that mean? Right? Words convey meaning. And so in asking a question, we're relying on those words to convey a meaning. That's why we use those words. But then what does it mean to not get tangled in the meaning of those words that we rely upon to convey something, but at the same time are limited? We're not going to figure that out, that's for sure. And so we have to practice. When the student asks Master Dungshan, how do you ask a great question? Dungshan said, not with your mouth, not with your tongue. It's not in the physical act of giving voice to words that have meaning. Then how do we ask? Master Dogen says, sometimes you study the way, you ask the great question by casting off the mind. Sometimes you ask the great question by taking up the mind. There is, after all, just one Dharma. In essence, there is just one practice. And there really is just one koan. And to work on that koan, this koan, what is it that has come like this, is just the path itself. You know, for those of us who've been doing this for a while, if you think about what were you thinking when you first came? Right? No, but I mean really, in a sincere way, you were thinking something, right? In terms of what was moving you, in terms of what you thought you were entering into, what this was, what was you were going to do. And then when you look back, when we look back, now how do we see it? Asking this great question. And you know, this is something that's a Zen tradition. You know, all the different traditions of Buddhism have, you know, there is one Dharma, and because of, you know, place and time and language and consciousness and culture, you know, each evolution of Buddhism in its own country and within its own lineages within those countries, you know, developed certain strengths, certain points of emphasis, brought some things out, other things maybe were not so taken up so much. And so in the Zen tradition, this question of inquiry, this question of questioning is very important. But sometimes students get tangled up in that and sort of hear it in a dualistic way, which means I have to have a question. What is the question I'm supposed to have? Right? Which is really an ass-backward way of looking at it. Right? It's like people who come into, you know, to present a koan and say, how can I express this? And I said, how do you express love? First, you love. First, you experience love, and then the expression will come. And so the question, what we speak of as a question, which is not a question, the question, it's inquiry, it's a mind that wants to know. It's the mind of bodhicitta. It's the mind that is no longer satisfied with samsara, with just going over it again. It's the mind that demands a life. I do not accept a facsimile of a life, a shadow of a life. And so that inquiry, which may not even be put into words, right? It may be, I think for most of us, that's what was functioning, right? I mean, if we had been met at the door and said, to gain entry, you have to be very clear about what it is you're seeking, most of us would have been turned away. I would have. I mean, in terms of any real understanding of what was moving me, I knew something was going on. But could I speak of it? No one had ever asked me that question before I came here. I'd never had to try and form it in language, in words, which meant I didn't have to actually get that clear about what was going on that I could even begin to do that. And so in taking up that inquiry, Dogen speaks about casting off the mind, taking up the mind. We can also think of it in terms of keeping that inquiry at the tip of your nose, as Master Da Wei said, so you never lose sight of it. And it's always in view. And you know that you are inquiring. And so a koan practice is kind of like that. But you can also just infuse it, have it be running throughout your whole body. And so you're inquiring without knowing, without looking directly. It says, Nanwei worked on this for 8 years. You know, what I love in the koans is these very simple little sentences. Oh, by the way, he worked on this for 8 years. Right? So we just sort of jump over that whole thing, right? From the moment of his first meeting, and then suddenly he comes back and he's seen it. So what the hell about those 8 years, right? What does it mean he worked on it for 8 years? And maybe had to even remind his teacher what it was he was working on. Oh, by the way, remember that question you asked me. A true inquiry is like that. It doesn't lose its flavor. Bodhicitta is like that. Dogen says, to study, which is to inquire, to examine, to want to know. And in that, you know, the First Noble Truth sort of established so strongly, so clearly, that that it begins and is based in this desire to be free of suffering. But it's not just, I don't want to feel pain anymore. I think if that's what any of us were really looking for, then we would just go find an easier way to stop that pain. Just not hurting is not enough. We want to understand what we're in the midst of. Isn't that, I don't know if it's uniquely human, but it is definitely the human, a signature of human consciousness, to want to understand what we are in the midst of. What is this life? And Dogen says, to study with mind, to inquire, means to study with various aspects of mind, such as consciousness, emotion, and intellect. So we could think of intellect as understanding what the question is. What should we be wondering about? What are the things that we should actually be asking? You know, when I first came into training, I wasn't thinking in terms of what is the nature of the self. That wasn't a question I'd really encountered, not in a direct way, not in the way that the Dharma is asking that question. And so when I first heard my teacher expressing that, it was sort of like, I wasn't sure I knew exactly what that meant. And it didn't resonate immediately. It wasn't like, oh yes, that's what I've been wondering. It wasn't that. That took time to understand what that question was asking. What is in the self as it's understood in the Dharma? Studying by intellect also means studying, seeing the limits of intellect. And so we both understand how it is important to understand, and we also see the limits of our understanding that way. Emotion we could think of as our heartfelt aspiration, as faith, as patience, as studying when emotions, all that is sort of nonverbal, we might say, within us is actually moving us closer and helping to free us, and when it's moving us away and getting us tangled. We could think of it also as the as that resonance, right, between the Dharma and this body and mind. Consciousness is the inquiry itself, awareness, the way. In the Lancet of Seated Meditation, Dogen says, let it be known that for studying the way, for inquiring into what is it that has come like this, the established means of study is pursuit of the way in seated meditation, the established way of inquiry. And the essential point here that marks this examination is the understanding that there is a practice of a Buddha that doesn't seek to make a Buddha. The essential point of our inquiry is that there is a practice of a Buddha that is not seeking to make a Buddha. And since the practice of a Buddha is not to make a Buddha, it is the realization of the koan. A very strong statement. This is the realization of the koan. The Buddha practicing to not make a Buddha. The moment when all seeking ceases. That is the nature of the koan, to be so filled with inquiry, not with your mouth and tongue, your whole body and mind. Sometimes when I ask students, how are you working on the koan? They say, I'm saying the words. I say, no. That will just keep you right on the surface. When all seeking ceases, the person, the time, the place, the awareness, the koan, the making of a Buddha, the escape from delusion. When the Buddha realizes not making a Buddha, the Buddha is realized. Nanwei said, to say it's like something misses it. And I've always found that very interesting, that from that Huainung goes on, well, he asks this testing question, right? Because to say it's like something misses it, I mean, almost every student says that at some point. Because it's something we come to understand on some level. But how do we understand that? How is Nanwei expressing that? All things stand alone in the universe. And in this aloneness, everything arises. So Dogen says, this human body means the four great elements in the five skandhas. However, none of these elements in skandhas is fully understood by ordinary people. Only sages thoroughly master them. That should get our attention. None of these elements in skandhas are fully understood by ordinary people. So when the Buddha taught about the nature of dukkha, he said it's not getting what you want, it's being with disagreeable people, it's sickness, old age, and death. And we can all understand those. And then he says, in short, it's the skandhas. What does that mean? In short, dukkha, all conditioned things, are suffering. is the skandhas. And Suisei spoke about this yesterday. Khyentsen Rinpoche said that when we think of form, in other words, how do we know? How do we know? How do we know we're alive? How do we know we're here? How do we know we're listening or giving this talk? How do we know that spring is coming? How do we know anything? So first, something has to appear. Khyentsen says, we use the word body to refer to ever-changing agglomerations of bones, flesh, and blood. But in truth, there is no such entity as a body. In truth, there is no such person in this body. There is no entity we call myself in this body. It is only an aggregate of parts. We take the body as the person. He says, feeling is the lasso that binds mind and object together. It's kind of a nice image, the lasso that pulls them together and binds them together, sensation. Examining it closely, it is empty of any entity. In that sensation, in that feeling, that's why in sitting, it's so important that when something arises, and everything that arises has sensation as we come into contact with it, is to see it without naming, narrative, idea, belief, because then we're no longer examining it closely. We can't, because now we're looking at the clothes that we just put on it. The history we've just given it. And so to sit in just experiencing, the experiencing of that sensation is how we can begin to examine it closely and ultimately see it has no entity within it. The third, what we chant is conception, conceiving. Khyentsen translates as appraisal, appraising. It's kind of nice. You know, before you buy something, you appraise it, before we appropriate. And he says, this is the moment when our mind is engaged in, this might please me, this could hurt me. And here we take both the assessor and our assessment as the entity, as me, as self. And then the fourth, what we call discrimination, he describes as impulse. Impulse, which is good, because it has that sense of being impulsive. And he describes it as the compulsion to implicitly believe in the message of one's own feelings. I added that, actually. Those aren't his words. The compulsion to implicitly believe in the message of our feelings, because every feeling comes with a message. And then to take action on the basis of that feeling. To want it, to reject it, and in so doing to create karma. And so impulse, he says, is the architect of samsara and nirvana. The architect. And yet within each impulse, there is no agent to be found. There is only that formation of mind. There is only that impulse. There is only that sensation that is to be experienced, the Buddha said, that is to be examined closely. And the reason it doesn't belong to us, he said, is because there's no agent. And then consciousness, Khyentsen Rinpoche says, is the kingpin of the skandhas. For it is this that clings to the skandhas as truly existing, as being myself. Looking closely, there is nothing that is consciousness. There is nothing that is person. Years ago, I talked about this book, Deep Survival. This guy, I can't remember his name, Gonzalez, I think. He he became really fascinated by people who were in intense survival situations where death seemed imminent. And of course, he's reporting on the ones who survive. And what determines between those who survive and those who don't? Because it's not necessarily based on what you would think, as in skills, knowledge, you know, rational understanding, and so on. And one of the things he talked about was how in a survival situation, as somebody gets further and further away from knowing where they are, that they begin to do what he called bending the map. And I remember once when I was out in Colorado many years ago, I was young and had just enough knowledge to be dangerous to myself. And I hitchhiked outside of town with my backpack and asked my driver, I said, I saw a mountain that looked good. And I said, oh, let me off here. And I just hiked across. I had no idea where I was. And also no one knew where I was. I just told my friend, I said, I'm going hiking for a few days. The things we survive. So I went off into the woods, into this mountain, being very totally unfamiliar with the Rockies. I'd never been out there before. But I thought, hey, it's just a mountain. And so I went I went hiking. And I did actually have a topographical map, so I was going to do some, I had a compass, and I was going to do some hiking for a few days. And I did that. And at a certain point, you know, I had sort of tracked a path that I wanted to do, get to a certain peak. And at a certain point, I wasn't completely sure that I was on my path. And I kept looking at the map and looking at my compass and looking at the terrain. And I remember in my mind thinking, that could work. You know? It's like that could almost kind of match. And that was my bending the map, right? I needed it to match what I needed it to be. I needed it to be what I wanted it to be. And the fact that the map was saying no, no, it's not what you think, I was like, yes, it is. It is. I am going to reshape this landscape. To believe in the message of our feelings, fear, and then to take action on the basis of those feelings. Obviously, I came out all right. And having learned a few things along the way, having been humbled, I might say. So the passage I read from Longchenpa on Wednesday, where he said, constantly deconstructing, investigating keenly, not even the slightest substance can be found. There is no agent, there is no entity, and in this undivided moment of non-dual perception, we abide in the natural state of perfection. That the natural state of perfection is realized when we see that there is no agent. That natural state of perfection is always present because the universe is, by its very nature, non-dual. But our experience does not match. The sensations, the way we understand those sensations, how we go responding to those sensations, the meaning that they have, doesn't match. It doesn't match what we're actually experiencing or what we're experiencing, what we're seeing. And so there's dukkha. Not matching means something's out of kilter, something's not harmonious. And so practice needs to be not constructing. He speaks of deconstructing. I've never really liked that, you know, because it suggests you're going to take this house apart, timber, you know, beam by beam, nail by nail. It's the house isn't there. It's realizing that the house is not there. Is realizing, illuminating our delusion. And so then he says, in the universal womb that is boundless space, all forms of matter and energy are perceived as nothing more than the flux of the five skandhas. Energy, winds, sensations passing through and passing beyond. Just here for a moment, passing beyond. And if we think about our life that way, that that's what life is, nothing more than just this moment of a coming together that forms itself rather exquisitely, we might say, magnificently in this moment, and then passes. And there is no agent, there's no entity, there's no one that can possess this that's like the, you know, the chief that's in control of it. And that might give us a feeling of being bereft somehow, or like, what's the point? Or, oh my God, I'm not that powerful. Or have we just misconstrued power? Are we not actually then liberated? It's to say it's like something misses it, but the sixth ancestor wants to know. That's true, but what do you understand? And so he says, does it depend upon practice and enlightenment? And this is a very important question. It's at the root of what the Buddha's own search, as he kept experiencing deeper and deeper states of meditation, accomplishing what these different teachers he was studying with had to offer, which they presented as liberation. And he kept realizing it's not liberation because it depends on something. It depends on this meditation. It depends on this state of mind. It depends on my maintaining something. And so when we think about wanting to maintain, preserve this, the mind of, that we come to bring forth in Zazen and Sesshin, when we leave, there's something genuine and good about that. We were seeing how we are affected and the world is affected when we're coming more from a place of stillness of samadhi and clearly seeing. But the idea of preserving it, right, is exactly that. We want our experience to depend, we want our freedom in our life to depend on that mind, that experience. And it can't. That wouldn't be freedom. And so it's not a philosophical question at all. It has everything to do with what practice actually is. And so Dogen begins this whole fascicle with this dialogue. It's not that there is no practice in enlightenment. It's just that we should not be defiled by them. How can we be defiled by practice and enlightenment? If practice is fundamentally good, if enlightenment is sort of the essence of goodness, of freedom, how can we be defiled by them? Experience the intimacy of things. Don't be defiled by the three treasures. Right? The precept is don't defile the three treasures, but how could we be defiled by the three treasures? What are we doing with our minds? Where have we placed practice and enlightenment? To put anything outside of ourselves is that defilement. And yet we must use the skandhas, dukkha, we must use this body, this fragile flesh, blood and bones, heading towards dust. We must use these emotions, these sensations, fickle though they are. How do we do that? That being the very place of our delusion. You know, I spoke about the other day about just the ancientness of this practice. You know, and to think about, we can think it, you know, we just sit, we have to get in a certain posture that has a kind of, you know, qualitative efficiency to it. It grounds you, right? You have to do something with it, right? So, but that's good. It's grounded, right? It's stable, right? Eventually it becomes more and more comfortable. That's a good thing, right? And then you concentrate on the breath. That's good. You're developing your concentration. That's good, right? And then we see clearly. And so we can think of this in a very kind of materialistic way. Materialistic as in mechanical. That the body is a machine. It's reducible to its parts. If we just make the parts work, then you get the desired result. I was reading this article about, it was titled, Why the Brain Prefers Paper. And it was a fairly unbiased, I think. It was really looking at digital readers and paper, you know, reading books and on paper. And drawing from all of these, there have been lots and lots of studies by all scientists in all different fields. And what they find, you know, even amongst people who really dig digital readers, is that comprehension is not the same. And this is also, you know, with improvements in digital readers in terms of, you know, contrast and light and so on. And this, the sort of the sensory experience of turning the page, you know, trying to sort of match this. And that they're trying to understand why. Like what's, particularly the makers of digital readers want to know why, right? Because what they find is that when people really want to study something carefully or really, or and retain it, that many people will go to paper, right? Without necessarily even thinking about it. So what's going on? So they've been really studying this. And the things that they talk about are so simple. And so that it's almost hard. It's like, what's going on? So they talk about just the physicality of the book. And of course, a digital reader has physicality too. But they say that with a book, you have two pages. So it's like you have this landscape. They're facing each other. You have eight corners, right? So you have this sort of, you have a landscape. And then with each page that you turn, it's like there's this sense of movement, of traveling, of having traveled. And then in the one hand, you can get a sense of how far you've traveled, and in the other hand, how far yet to go, right? And that there's a mental kind of mapping, they think, that is happening. You know how it is when you want to find a certain passage and you think, I think that was on the top right-hand page. Right? And whether you're right or not is not so much the point. It's that we've actually made a mental map out of just symbols on a page. And so that's kind of interesting. But I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, what does it mean to be a sentient being? What does it mean to practice? What is mysticism? What is the entry into not knowing? What is it to really understand the limits of what is measurable? And so in this simple example, and maybe it's not so simple even, what is actually working there, right? Because it's not just what we prefer. I like the way it feels, but it actually seems to have to do with what I actually absorb, right? Its influence on me. And so we're physical beings. We have skandhas. And we live in a physical world. And that is an ancient, the oldest relationship there is. Right? Our relationship with physicality and the physicality of other things. And so over these these millennia, we have evolved as physical beings in relationship with our physical world. And just because we've moved indoors so much doesn't mean that we're no longer living in a physical world. And so how are we affected by these things? How are we affected by light? Right? What happens to us, right, on a morning like, on a day like today, or was it yesterday when the sun really came out? Right? It's been so cloudy, it's hard to remember. And so it feels good, right? It's nice to see the sun, it's getting warm, that's nice. But what else is happening, right? As day by day the light increases, it starts to, you know, you notice now that in the middle of morning sitting, the sky is starting to dawn, right? And then as it gets warmer, the air becomes more pungent, right? And then we begin to see things, buds, green, sprouts, critters. And we can just note those. Maybe we delight in them. Maybe they make us feel a certain way. But what else is going on? How long have we been inquiring into this life in the midst of this? And then we come into practice and we take this physical body and we place it very attentively. And we turn our attention to the breath very attentively. How old is that relationship? And we enter into stillness and silence. How old is that relationship? How long have people been doing this? And not just in meditation, not just in, you know, formal meditation. How are we affected by the world we live in? How are we the world we're living in? And all the ways that we may be aware of it, and the innumerable ways, things that we're not aware of, but that are affecting us. You know, how affected are we, just in our mood and our temperament, by the long days and nights of winter, the cold, the light? How then are we affected when spring comes? How are we affected by the environment of our politics, our public discourses, the way we treat each other, the news that we read? This is our environment, right? These are the forms that arise. These are the feelings that we come and have when we come into contact, the appraisals, the impulses. And so when Dogen says the sun, moon, and stars as seen by human beings are not the same, how does a tree experience spring? I was hearing an interview recently with some scientists who were studying, you know, the intelligence, because what do we call it, of plants? And you know, the mimosa plant, that if you touch the leaf, that the it's like kind of fern life and it folds in. And so they did this experiment where they found a way to kind of startle it so that it folds in. And then they did that over and over and over and over. And every time they did it, it's folded, 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 again, again, again. And then once, it didn't fold. Didn't fold. And then they came back the next day and startled it. It didn't fold. Is that memory? How could how would a plant remember, right? We can only think in the way that we experience things. So we think of memory, right? It's retaining something. We call that memory. But what is that for a plant? And then 28 days, I think 28 because their grant ran out or something like that. The vagaries of science. It's still remembered. And they thought, well, maybe it just got numb. You know, it just checked out, like maybe like we do, right? And so, but then they startled it in another way. Nope, folds. So it seemed to have learned that that stimulation was safe, was okay. Is it learning? Can we even think in terms of learning? That's all we know. How does a plant be a plant? They did another experiment, thinking of Pavlov's dog. You know, meet, bell, eat. Meet, bell, eat. Meet, bell, eat. Meet, bell, eat. And then bell, no meat, drool. Right? Wanting to eat. And so they did that with a plant. They blew a fan on the plant, no reaction. Right? Neutral. And then they put a light right next to the fan. And the plant moved towards the light. Right? And then they move the fan and the plant and the light, and the plant moved towards the light. And they moved it again and moved towards the light again and again and again. It kept always moving. And then they took away the light and just blew the fan. Moves towards the fan. So what is that? Is that conditioning? Is that samskaras for the plant? Right? A mental formation? Is that a habit pattern? Is that delusion? You know, to think about how vast our consciousness is and also how incredibly limited. We only can know the way we know things. And our hubris, of course, is to think that if something doesn't resemble that, then it doesn't have anything like that. It doesn't have intelligence. It doesn't have the capacity to communicate. It doesn't have the capacity to help another of its kind. And yet, over and over and over again, that is seen to be not true. So what other kinds of intelligences are there? And what can we learn from that in terms of our own hubris, in terms of our love for all things, in terms of our respect for different kinds of intelligence? I mean, what if I had been born as a tree? How would I see the world? How would I? How can I even ask the question? If I had been born as a woman, if I had been born with darker skin, if I'd been born wealthy, if I'd been born very poor, if I'd been born in a war-torn country, same genetics, who would I be? How would I see the world? Of course, I don't know the answer to that question. There is no way to know the answer to that question, but to know that I am here because of those skandhas, because of all that I have experienced, and this. And that's the basis upon which I practice, you practice. That's the basis upon which we come like this. And so to appreciate that the wonder of this bodied world, and the wonder of it, and how much of it is beyond our understanding. But to appreciate how the ancientness, right, of what we are doing, and to trust more in the wisdom of not just what we do, but how we do it. That when we return to our cushion every day, when we chant these vows every day, when we do these prostrations, these are ancient practices, ancient ways of using this body, this world of sensation, and coming into contact. Like, what influence does an altar have? We have certain experiences, we relate in certain ways, we might have certain feelings, but what other ways is that affecting us? Ways that we're not registering. Why have these things been around for so long? What are they communicating? What are they invoking? What are they awakening within us? What kind of concert are we in together, working together, finding unity with this world? Just this non-defilement is what Buddhas have maintained and transmitted. You are like this, I am like this, all of the ancestors are like this. Just this non-defilement, just this basic nature, just this. And just this covers the universe, includes everything. What would we discount? Because we don't yet understand something, haven't experienced something, would we decide that can't be? That is not true? Would we not inquire? Not at least in the spirit of inquiry, be a little open, wonder? I think that's the better path. To leave all doors open and see how they meet. And so when we're sitting and we're consumed or focusing on what we need to focus at, which is right in front of us, you know, to also appreciate that what is in front of us is much, much more than that. and that the effects of our practice in every moment is much more than what we can know. And over time, we do see that. We see more and more of what is actually happening, what we have been doing. We begin to understand more and more what we've actually been doing. In other words, we begin to see more broadly, more deeply. Would that ever end? Would there be any limit to that? And how marvelous, how magnificent, how wondrous. Not that makes the world, but that shows us that the world is. And then the suffering that we create out of our selfishness just becomes so much more painful, unfortunately. Because it's such a desecration. It's so unnecessary. And yet, that's where we need to practice. And so you are like this, I am like this. Hallelujah.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.